is in respect for our tradition for helping those who are in need. And certainly at this time of year, that's something that, while should always be foremost in our thoughts, I think becomes even more apparent during the holiday time. So I invite the children to come forward to bring that food and stay for the Time for All Ages story.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Rachel White, and I'm the Director of Religious Education here at UCF. And this morning, we'll be reading The Boy Who Cried Wolf, a classic fairy tale. In a small, quiet village high in the mountains lived a young shepherd boy. It was his responsibility to keep the village safe from the hungry wolf that lived deep in the Badville Forest. Every day, all day, the boy monitored the sheep's safety. The days were long and could seem very ordinary and uneventful. Sometimes the boy would find clever ways to keep busy. He even named the sheep funny names. Hello, Tazalakis. Hello there, Zambini. The boy had never seen the so-called hungry wolf. Not even once. Sometimes he even wondered if it was real. All the boy knew was if he spotted the hungry wolf, he would simply use his loud voice to yell and scream. Hearing the cry would alarm the villagers that their sheep were in danger. When he was on duty one day, the boy had a mischievous thought. He said to himself, "What would happen if I yelled and screamed? Would anyone really notice? Would anyone really come running up the hill to the rescue?" Rather than brush off the devious thought, the boy continued to convince himself it was an exciting idea. He thought, "Okay, I will do this once. I need to know what would really happen." And so he ran down the mountain with his hands waving in the air as he cried for help. Hearing the yelp, the villagers stopped what they were doing. They quickly came running from their farms and homes and climbed up the mountainside to help him scare up the hungry wolf and protect their animals. However, when they got there, the sheep were calmly chewing on the green grass. The boy couldn't help but laugh as more and more villagers breathlessly arrived. It was as if he created a whole circus by simply shouting. Soon the townspeople asked the boy why he had alarmed them. They could see no sheep were in danger. The boy giggled as he explained, "It was a good old-fashioned prank. No sheep are in trouble. It was only a funny joke." And the boy hooted some more. The villagers were not impressed by the foolish prank. They slowly turned back to go to their farms and homes. Even after the villagers went down the mountain, the boy continued chuckling to himself. Their expressions were so funny, he thought. They were so surprised. He knew he shouldn't do it again. Jokes can only be funny once. Or are they? As the quiet minutes alone turned into hours, the boy decided the joke was simply too funny just to try once. The boy quietly practiced his panic voice and laughed as he thought how entertaining it would be to him. Then he counted, 1, 2, and at 3 he yelled as loud as possible. Then he cried, "Wolf! Wolf!" in a desperate voice. The villagers ran up the mountain, ready to protect the sheep from the predator. As the villagers approached the boy, he saw the concern and look of fear on the villagers' faces again. But he couldn't hold in the amusement any longer. "You all thought it was the hungry wolf had come attack the sheep," the boy began howling in laughter. "But it is all a big funny joke," the boy belted out loudly, barely able to speak as he tried to control his laughter. When he looked at the sour and disappointed faces of the villagers, he began to feel badly, but only for a few seconds. Because every time the boy thought about the villagers trudging breathlessly up the mountainside to hunt down a pretend wolf, he started to laugh. The townspeople shook their heads and mainly scowled as they slowly made their way back down the mountain. Again, all alone, the boy started daydreaming. daydreaming about what the funny prank he had done. He thought that he would be known as the funniest boy in the village. He began daydreaming. Would I ever really see a hungry wolf? Wait, a wolf? As the boy gazed into the field, he rubbed his eyes. As clearly as day, he could see a big, hairy dog on the other side of the field. Thank goodness it was only a dog. But as the beast got closer, he saw the mean face and snarling teeth. Reality set in. This was no dog. This was a big, furry, hungry wolf. Without even thinking, the boy yelled in panic. Wolf! He screamed and ran to the edge of the mountain where he could see the villagers tilling their fields below. Two of the villagers looked up, shook their heads, and continued with their activities. Again, the boy screamed, this time with all the breath he had. Despite the loud, frantic calls for help, the villagers continued with their chores. It was no use. The sheep were unprotected, and the hungry wolf enjoyed a lamb supper. The boy knew he had let down the village, and as a result, the villagers no longer trusted him. The boy felt remorse for his repeated impractical jokes. In fact, the boy learned an important lesson from this disappointing day. Be honest, and people will trust you. Humor is funny only when it doesn't cause people trouble. Respect all people. Respect their time and property. As many years passed, the boy became a wise man. In fact, he proved himself one of the most trustworthy people in the village. The lessons he remembered when he cried wolf served him well. He found the most meaningful principle that he had learned was that mistakes often become some of life's most valuable learning moments.
This morning we're talking about truth, and one of the ways that I think we can better go on that journey toward finding truth and meaning in our world is by being in community. And of course, one of the ways that we do that is through sharing the joys and sorrows in our lives, the things that are too great to hold alone. And as we begin this morning, I would like to offer a sorrow. This is on behalf of our office administrator, Rita Salama. Her father passed away this week. So she is currently flew out to be with her sister and her stepmother and deal with that. So please keep Rita in your thoughts as you go forward this week. And I invite anyone else who has a brief personal joy or sorrow they would like to share or an update on someone to come forward and do so.
Thank you. Hama. There. I want to thank everyone in the church for your sympathy and help. It's been very helpful. And I know Brad would love to see some all of you are at his rehab center on Baston Cherry and Harper. And I wish to thank my girlfriends who have been exceptionally kind and taking me places and stuff, something to give your mind a little rest. Thank you very much. Thank you, all of you. And he's not doing well, but it's hard to tell.
And the rehabilitation home is called Terrace Hill, correct?
Terrace Hill.
Terrace Hill.
Best
Cedar, Baston Cherry, and Harbor. There is a big drugstore on the corner. What is it? CVS. Go around that, and in the back, there's where Brett is.
Thank you.
Well, I'm Will, so I have a joy to share, which is that my sister, Melissa, has come from Santa Fe, partly simply as a family visit, but also to help me mark my 75th birthday here, which is tomorrow. So.
As always, we know the joys and sorrows spoken in this room are just the beginning of what might be happening in people's lives. And so we hold that knowledge close as we move forward in our interactions with one another.
Before we move into our time of meditation this morning, I wanted to share with you a story from my own life that's related to the theme of truth that Reverend Lee Marie will be talking about later. And this took place when I was about 10 years old. My cousin and I found ourselves with our parents at a county fair. And there was a midway there with, you know, all those rides, hastily constructed rides, I imagine. But we begged, could we please buy tickets for something? And they finally said, you can go on one thing. So we had to figure out, what would we do? And so what looked most intriguing was the fun house that was set at the very back of the midway. You know, this usually it was this serene Indiana field, and here was this, you know, thing with twinkling lights, this house of mystery. And my cousin and I were sure that some kind of wonderful adventure awaited us inside. So our parents bought the tickets, and we gave them to the weary, tattooed man who stood by the turnstile. And then we found ourselves inside the mirror maze that sort of was out in front before you actually got into the house proper, so to speak. So, with the confidence of youth, my cousin and I set off through this mirror maze. Sure, we could easily find our way. But everywhere we looked, there were more reflections. There was no path we could really find. Again and again, we found ourselves at yet another dead end, trapped by our reflections, which were us, but not us at the same time. Truth wasn't to be found in those images. Neither was a true path to be found in that maze, nothing but dead ends and frustration. Finally, we were defeated, and we carried our 10-year-old selves back out the way we had come, out the front entrance, going the wrong way through the turnstile and past the now grinning, tattooed attendant. We had given up somewhere in there. There is a path that must be found, but we could not find it. A maze of images and reflections that weren't quite reality. We didn't know how to make our way through it. I have to admit that I wondered for years after that, what was in the fun house that we never actually made it into? Probably nothing important. But for two kids who had begged to walk through it, I always wish we had persisted until we had found our way. We had given up looking for the way forward, even though we knew it had to be there somewhere. Will you please join me in prayer, meditation, and reflection? The search for truth is not an easy one. In today's world, we find ourselves in a maze of voices and images and ideas all competing for our attention. And yet we are called by our faith tradition to forge a path to move forward, to find through all the chaos that surrounds us something that is real, that is true. Sometimes we know reality all too well. The struggles and sorrows in our lives, the illnesses and conflict, the tension, the anxieties that characterize our days. And sometimes we lose our way. And sometimes when we are feeling most lost, the connections we have in our immediate communities, in our families, those help us to find the path again. I invite you to consider now, in our moment of silence, the nature of truth and the path that we forge to find it. Let us be open to the ever-constant search for truth and meaning in our world, even when it's hard, even when it's difficult, even when we find ourselves confused and not knowing which way to turn. Amidst the isolation that we can sometimes feel, let us hold ourselves open to community as a compass that can guide us to what is true.
Thank you. 14 years ago now, in 2005, the Colbert Report debuted on national television. Can you believe it was 14 years ago? If you recall, Stephen Colbert, then playing his right-wing populist commentator character, performed a feature he called The Word. His first subject was truthiness. In character, just imagine, he said, now, I'm sure some of those word police, you know, those wordnistas over there at Webster, they're going to say, hey, truthiness is not a word. Well, anybody knows that I'm no fan of dictionaries or reference books. I mean, they're elitist. They're constantly telling us what is or is not true, or what did or did not happen. Who's Britannica to tell me that the Panama Canal was finished in 1914 if I want to say it was finished in 1941? I don't trust books, he went on. They're all fact, no heart. Face it, folks, we are a divided nation. He said this 14 years ago. And those who think with their head are different than those who think with their heart. Because that's where truth comes from, ladies and gentlemen, from the gut. Well, researchers at the University of California, Irvine, came up with an unsettling precondition for truthiness. They determined that the less effort it takes to figure out if something is factual, the more accurate a claim can seem to mean. In other words, if a claim snaps neatly into our existing belief structures, we are filled with a sense of comfort, familiarity, and warmth, trust, which makes it seem credible. Those who embrace an ultra-conservative ideology, those with ultra-right political beliefs, are responding to something in their predator neural wiring, needing to manage uncertainty and threat. Maybe why they can be so powerfully persuaded about those hordes of immigrants, you know, that are pouring over the border, so we have to build a wall. But oh, what about those alternative facts? This was the phrase used by the counselor to the president, Kellyanne Conway, when she defended the then White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, who just got knocked off of Dancing with the Stars, if you've been watching with that. His remarks were blatantly false, easily disproven, embarrassingly stupid about the attendance numbers at Trump's inauguration. Remember that? Those photographs? Hilarious, but not so funny. The origin of the idea of alternative facts comes from the 1949 fictional dystopian novel 1984 by George Orwell, which portrays a totalitarian state with limited freedom of thought, creating its own language. Remember that newspeak? Words with negative meanings were removed, so bad becomes good, and was declared that freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, and war is peace. Within days of the false alternative facts reporting at the Trump's inauguration, the publisher of 1984 had to order a 75,000 reprint. The book became the Amazon bestseller of 2016. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, some of you know who he was, Harvard-honed four-term United States Senator from New York, United Nations Ambassador, advisors to President John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Nixon, famously said, "You are entitled to your own opinion, but you are not entitled to your own facts." This was a man who distinguished himself because he derived his policy positions from research rather than cherry-picking statistics to justify his policies. That's how he propelled himself to the forefront of issues like auto safety and climate change, as well as the question of the durability of, you know, that place over in the East, the Soviet Union? Daniel Borenstein, a conservative, was an American historian at the University of Chicago who wrote on many topics in American and world history. He was appointed the 12th librarian of the United States Congress in 1975 and served until 1987. In his 1961 book, The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, warned that we, here in the United States, risk being the first people in history to have been able to make their illusions so vivid, so persuasive, so realistic that they can live in them. On January 16th, at the beginning of this year, not joking here, bogus newspapers with a giant headline, "Unprecedented, Trump hastily departs the White House, ending his crisis." Well, they were delivered to commuters in Washington, D.C. on the subway, and under a banner that said Washington Post, and it looked just like the Washington Post. It was fake news that people thought was real news. Then, on a website, which closely resembled WAPO's website, a story about a secret resignation of Trump and the swearing-in of Pence appeared, both of which the Post had to rush right away to say, "More fake news, people!" A group which described itself as Trickster Activist Collective said it had produced both the bogus newspapers and the new website. The stunt, of all things, may have been a promotion to draw negative attention to, of all things, the upcoming Women's March. You know how they're always doing that? They want to have something more tantalizing in the news than what's actually happening. Media technologies today are so advanced that everyone from Snopes.com to FBI are having difficulties parsing out the real from the fake news, in discerning the validity of all things today, videos. The old joke by Groucho Marx, "Who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?" Well, even that's more difficult now with the way they can change those videos. From an article in The Atlantic magazine about his book, Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, Peabody Award-winning public radio host and writer Kurt Anderson proposed that little by little, for centuries, then more and more faster during the last half century, we Americans have given ourselves over to all kinds of magical thinking. And most of us haven't realized how far-reaching our strange new normal has become. Anderson reports, much more than the other billion or so people in the developed world, we Americans believe, really believe, in the supernatural, the miraculous, in Satan on earth, in reports of recent trips to and from heaven, and in the story of an instantaneous creation several thousand years ago. Think of the willingness of so many people to believe in all kinds of conspiracy theories concerning assassinations, 9/11, AIDS, and lately, vaccines. People could die. People have died because they have bought into these things. We are now familiar with the terms post-factual and post-truth. Perhaps the solidly reality-based now are the minority. It's probably us. It's maybe a third of the U.S. policy that believes fake news, and that's scary. More than half of the people surveyed in the United States say they're absolutely certain that heaven exists, and just as many are sure that there is a personal God. Now, this isn't a vague idea. This isn't a force. This is not nature. This is not community. So many of the ways that we as Unitarian Universalists describe this, but as a guy with a white beard and a pool table and a pool cue trying to show where we're going. Kurt Anderson thinks that one reason is religion. He writes, the GOP is now explicitly conservative Christian. The party is a coalition of white Christians papering over doctrinal and class differences, and now led, weirdly, by one of the least moral presidents ever. Adding that if more and more of a political party's members hold more and more extreme views, extravagantly supernatural beliefs, it makes more sense that they are willing to believe almost anything politically. And I think this is one of the most important reasons that I'm a UU, and why I think our faith tradition is essential to U.S. culture and to the world. There have been times when I, as DRE, many years ago, Director of Religious Education, as you know, people would arrive at the church for the first time. I had a very large building behind our church. I had 150 children then. Things are different now. And we had 150 adults in the same congregation. Very child-centered congregation. They would come and they'd be crying and they would be so happy that they had found a place for their children to learn the truth. And I'd say, "This is great. I'm so glad you're here." And they'd say, "Yeah, we are too, because we can believe anything." No. Hypothetically, yes, Unitarian Universalists have no prescribed statement or creed of belief that they need to sign, that they must believe in. However, our congregations covenant together to affirm and promote our principles and our sources, which describe our highest aspirations about how we want to live together in the world. Our values are called what is commonly agreed upon among us. They're not commandments, they are aspirations. Our fourth principle lifts up a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Of course, each one of us is on a spectrum somewhere between the poles of rational and irrational thought. We do that every day, that's normal. But we take seriously our responsibility to hold up the truth. The truth, the search for truth and meaning, is as old as humankind. And today, the best framework for our task is probably the scientific method. This is unlike what many other religious traditions and/or spiritual quests may be so comfortable to referring. The scientific method employs both a thoughtful combination of direct experience and reason to parse out the fact from fiction, truths from untruths, what is likely from what is unlikely. Added to that, it's going to require us time and patience. It might be frightening or uncomfortable for us as this search continues to challenge us. These are hard times. It may put us at odds with the people we love, or those perhaps who espouse unscientific or supernatural beliefs. But at the heart of our Unitarian Universalist faith, as it always has been, and I hope it will continue to be, is a search for reason. February 12th, early this year, coming soon, was the birthday of Charles Darwin, naturalist and biologist known for his theory of evolution and the process of natural selection. I'm sure many of you know he was a British Unitarian. Born in 1809, Charles Darwin this year was 210. His 211th birthday is coming up. His theory of evolution by natural selection is universally accepted by scientists in biological and related fields today. The worrisome thing, though, is that because evolution is not blindingly obvious, only about one-third of Americans believe in evolution. And they do this over and over again in surveys because it's so hard to believe. Only one-third of our citizens believe in evolution. We do not want to err on one side by accepting ideas and practices which have no grounding in reason, and on the other side, rejecting those which might provide us with new insights or new ideas. Our responsibility in our search for truth and meaning is that we can live what is real and true at the present, but we need to remain open to modifications to what might be in our future. if and when our continuing search might yield to us new evidence or new avenues. There has been, since the very joining of our two branches, Unitarianism and Universalism, a tension between mind and spirit, thinking and feeling, reason and intuition. But this no longer can be characterized simply as humanist and theist, if it really ever was. Today we are liberally using the word spirituality. We have to be careful when we use the word spirituality, or hear people, even ourselves, say, "I'm more spiritual than religious." Well, folks, the reason we're sitting in this congregation today is we are religious. This is a religion. We have 400 years of history always looking for the reasonable explanation for our spiritual beliefs. Our famous 19th century Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, who thousands would flock to hear on Sunday morning, wrote, "Be ours a religion, which like sunshine goes everywhere, its temple all space, its shrine the good heart, its creed all truth, its ritual works of love." May it be so. Amen, yamen, and blessed be.
Thank you, Reverend Lee Marie, for making us think about the nature of truth. We have a responsive reading. The words are from Frederick Douglass. Your part will be in yellow. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground.
They want rain without thunder. They want the ocean without the awful roar of waters.
This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle.
Power concedes nothing but God's demand. It never did and it never will.
Find out what people will submit to, and you have found out the exact amount of injustice which will be imposed upon them.
The limits of tyrants are described by the endurance of those whom they oppress.
Mahatma Gandhi said, "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall." Think of it, always. One of the ways we ensure that always, that triumph of truth, is by supporting communities like UUCF. And our offering is a vital way that we show our gratitude for all that we have here. By giving to UUCF, we know that this community of caring and this continued search for truth and meaning amidst the challenges of this world, that continues. We thank you for your generosity. Our closing hymn is As Tranquil Streams, and I believe Lee Marie had a couple of points she wanted to make about that hymn.
I understand this is one of those hymns that you don't sing very often here, and actually it's not sung very often in most of our congregations, but it's an important one. And I want to tell you that the lyrics were written by a woman named Marian Franklin Hamm in 1933 to celebrate the growing relationship between our two faith traditions in 1933, between Unitarianism and Universalism. Realizing the diversity increasing in each of those traditions, and that they shared more than they would be divided, the Unitarians and the Universalists decided to eventually consolidate. As the final votes were cast to form a new Unitarian Universalist Association in 1961, it was almost 30 years after she wrote this, the assembled body of our heretofore two denominations at a general assembly sang this rousing hymn together to celebrate our new unity. It must have been exciting, and I would love for you to sing it in a way that excites you.
So please rise in mind, body, or spirit. Helps us sing a little bit more excited.
Extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Would you please join hands for our closing words?
This was written by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and I think his words are important to us as much now as ever before as we defend the truth, as we do so in love, so that we may claim the power for justice. He said, this is where we are. Where do we go from here? First, we must massively assert our dignity and worth. We must stand up amidst a system that will still oppress us, our unassailable and majestic sense of values. What is needed is a realization that the power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice. And justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. And this is what we must see as we move on. And I say, that's the truth.
Until we meet again, amen, shalom, salam, namaste, and blessed be. Go now in peace.